Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to Tea and Murder, an Agatha Christie podcast. I'm your host, Rebecca Tendy Norman. Here we're part interview show, part book club, all Agatha Christie. And I am so thrilled to have with me today Paula Sutton. Paula is a content creator and author of the popular blog Hill House Vintage and the book Hill House Living, The Art of Creating a Joyful Life. Welcome, Paula.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me. I'm very excited.
Oh, I'm so happy for you to be here. And so tell me a little bit about your relationship to Agatha Christie's work. Are you a reader of her in general? Do you know a lot about her work? And do you have particular favorites?
Well, you know, it's quite interesting because what I'm really known for is my love of cottagecore and all things pretty and vintage. And so I think a lot of people find it quite weird that I'm into murder mysteries. But it all comes from my childhood, to be honest. It came from a period of my life when my parents lived in this country and I was a little girl and we used to actually watch films. So my love of the actual novels of Agatha Christie came firstly from watching the films. So we'd watch, I don't know, Peter Ustinov and sort of Death in the Nile. Or, you know, my mother loved old Hollywood. Mm. So we would always have those old black and white films or, you know, as they went into glorious Technicolor. And that piqued my interest into, well, you know, what a fantastic story. And those sorts of films back in my childhood, which is the 70s and 80s, you didn't want to come out of them. So once a film had ended and you sort of like submerged and immersed yourself so much into them, it was always a natural thing to go onto the book because yeah. Books last longer in your mind and in your heart, I always feel.
That's right.
I think that often the film is like your first taster. And it's, you know, it might present the visuals, but the book is where you really get into the characters and you really start understanding the reasons behind people's motivation. And you hear the backstories, all the things that films often can't do. So, yes, I started off, which is perhaps slightly unusual, but I started off with the films and then went into the novels of Agatha Christie. And of course, for me, I'm just so enchanted by visions and the feeling of the past. It's a very aesthetic thing for me. I, you know, as a black woman, I obviously know that, you know, place me in 1920s or 1930s on the Orient Express, and I wouldn't have the same privileges as I have now, unfortunately. So I'm very aware of, you know, when you're immersing yourself into that sort of genre, you're sort of in a bubble if you're into a certain period of time.
That's true.
But if you can go beyond that and get yourself into the story, then my goodness, they're a brilliant romp of a story, aren't they?
Absolutely. And I do think there is a lot of connection that people have to the aesthetic of her books, not only because of the time period, but because Christie herself is very good at describing setting. And your kind of interest in that particular vintage aesthetic, like what does it mean to you? Because I think, as you were saying, as a black woman, the time period means something different, but the aesthetic, in a sense, when we like develop a love for an aesthetic that maybe doesn't love us back with the time period, mm-hmm. there's a reclamation of sorts within that. Mm-hmm. What does mm-hmm. that mean to you?
What it means to me, that the reason I'm so drawn to the past and drawn to a very vintage aesthetic, it's all coziness to me. Now, my parents came over to England in the late 50s, early 1960s, and it was almost a period set in time in sort of London in the 1960s in England. My parents came from a Caribbean country. In their mind, they had the Queen as the head of the Commonwealth. And so, you know, they were all brought up with, it's a very different time as now, but they were all brought up with pictures of the Queen and how she would live. And they copied a very English, very British aesthetic. And what that meant is that the homes that they created when they first came over to England had a mix of Caribbean, but with very English, very British, almost more British than the British. So you had the sort of little knitted doilies that you would put your, as coasters, that you'd put your glasses down on. And you had your lovely tapestry cushions. And you had very, very English vintage feel. And that's obviously stayed with me. I you know, it's never left me. It makes me feel cozy and comforted and calm. And it makes me feel of home. And those sorts of films are all set in that time period that England almost got stuck in for about three decades.
Yeah.
You know, and then suddenly,
yeah.
Suddenly the 80s came and everything was flashy and sort of like sharp-edged and, you know, and white and bright and modern. Mm. But before that, we were sort of caught in this world of low light and, you know, sort of cozy times and being shops closing half day on a Wednesday and nothing being open on a Sunday. So there was this period of time that I remember as my sort of childhood and when I was a teenager. And I do remember it with fondness, where it was very old fashioned in feel.
Yeah.
And so when I look at books, I'm sorry, read books, or if I look at films that are of a certain period, it does remind me of a lovely period of time, even though, as you say, that the actual real period of time that we're talking about wasn't necessarily the kindest for many people. It's not even people of colour. It's, you know, anyone who was not a certain class, race or, you know, background.
Yeah.
So, you know, everyone was having a hard time in the 1920s and 1930s.
Yeah.
But there is a romanticism to it that is steeped in the aesthetic as opposed to the reality of what life was like at the time.
Yeah. And what are the pitfalls of romanticizing that that you have found, and how do you kind of, or do you try to actively avoid them, or do you just kind of take it as part of your work?
Well, the biggest pitfall, of course, is people assuming that, oh gosh, wasn't it better in the olden days? Wouldn't it be wonderful to go back to those times? I wish we were back then. Of course we don't.
Right.
You know, I'm very much steeped in 2023. I love being in 2023.
Yeah.
I just like dressing like Miss Marple. That's all.
But I love that. And I mean, when you were speaking about a lot of the elements that you love, the shops closing at 3 on a Wednesday and so on, I think what you're talking about is also a pace of life. And
exactly.
And I think that the Christie books really reflect that. And a lot of it has to do with kind of these people who live in family homes, you know, large manor houses where you go away for long periods of time, travel used to take months and months. So you would go away for
Absolutely.
Half a year. So I really do think that what you're talking about in that pace of life is a lot of what people find so comforting, because we do live
exactly.
in an incredibly fast paced world. And we'll never recover that pace, you know.
That's it. And I think, and in many ways, it's very good. You know, I know my children would be aghast if I wanted to sort of drag them back to 1930s, even just for the pace. And I have a good friend called Dandy Wellington, who is a big band leader and a wonderful sort of content creator who lives in New York.
Mm.
And he has a motto, and he dresses in fantastic sort of 1940s and 1950s gear. I mean, just the most amazing person.
Mm.
And he has a motto, which is vintage style, not vintage values.
I love
and
that.
Exactly. And it's such an important thing. And there's lots of people who sort of dress up in the aesthetic and they love to. I mean, it's a wonderful period of dressing, isn't it? Sort of like anything from the 1900s to perhaps the 19... I draw the line at 1969, the year that I was born. You know, 1970s you can take. 1970s onwards you can take.
Yeah.
But it's a wonderful period of dressing. But I think we have to remember that we are thinking, you know, so much of how we look on the past is due to how beautiful it can seem. It's not the reality of the people. So vintage style, not vintage values, I think is a wonderful phrase to use.
Yes.
And I think it sort of like separates the romantic side of what we're drawn to with the actual reality.
Yeah, and I like it because it also it already takes on the criticism that I think a lot of vintage lovers get, which is how can you love this period so much when so many people were treated so terribly? Yeah. And exactly, if you address it head on and say, this for me is really about aesthetic, pace of life, craftsmanship, looking back on a period where I particularly like the way colors were used or the way windows were built at that time or whatever. I think addressing that head on is the most perfect way to deal with it.
That's it. I mean, I'm not going to refuse to use my beautiful dovetail furniture, you know, my furniture that's been made beautifully and comes from a certain age just because of what other people were doing. You know, I'm not going to go to sort of like plastic furniture that's going to break just because I'm making a stand. You know, my stand comes from my emotions and how I feel about a certain period of time. But you know what? Keep away from my frocks and keep away from the skirts because you know what? They're a great shape. They flatter me, you know, and that's okay. That's good.
Absolutely. And there's nothing more like real than just standing by the things that you find beauty and joy in. I think that when people try to take that away from you, it's just such an unnecessary cruelty in life to have the things that you love and find joy in taken from you.
I think so. I think it's all about understanding and knowledge and having your mind open to what something really means and where it comes from.
Yes.
And just being self-aware and not pretending to oneself.
That's right.
And once you can do that, you can look at things, you know, you can look at things and see them for what they are. So the beauty of a chair or the beauty of an interior, it can, you know, we can go and look at, you know, maybe Agatha Christie's house, and maybe there's the house and it remains how it was when she died, perhaps. And we can appreciate that. We don't have to always drag the ghosts of the past to be sitting in those chairs at the time when we're looking. You know, we could appreciate what we're seeing now.
Yes.
And the two can live side by side, I feel, often.
Yeah. And we can also trust people to understand the difference in, you say, as the aesthetic versus the values. And that's such a conversation that kind of the Agatha Christie community seems to be having, which is how do we continue reading these books when not only are they set in a period maybe where the values weren't the same, but often she uses slurs, she uses language that we find offensive and inappropriate and would never fly now. And and that's an ongoing conversation about how do we as modern readers deal with these books because they're as popular as ever.
Absolutely. And that is a very hard question because even my children, I have three children. I've got twin girls who are 19 years old and my son is 22.
Oh, wow.
And they had no idea about the original title of And Then There Were None.
Yeah.
You know, they've seen the film adaptations. They know that I love a good Agatha Christie novel. But they were shocked to realise that originally there was a completely different title.
Yeah.
And it is hard to sort of reconcile the two things because the story, if you take that away, the story is a great story. It's a great murder mystery. But at the same time, how awful that the title is so bad that it had to be changed, you know. So you do have to sort of think on, you know, people shouldn't just be blindly forgiven, I suppose, for you know, for attitudes and theories and whatever. There are enough people who were very open to progression and who understood the problems with certain words and certain phrases, even back then.
Yes.
So it's not that we should give a blanket, you know, oh, it's fine. But at the same time, you know, in terms of as a storyteller, she's an incredible storyteller. Yeah. As a person who creates these amazing characters that you actually really want to get into the backstory and you really want to sort of understand and analyze their mind, she's great at all of that. Mm-hmm. So there is a balance. There is a balance. It's not a sweeping absolution.
Yeah.
It can never be.
No.
But at the same time, you know, I don't believe in burning books and getting rid of books either.
No. So. I agree. And I also think with someone like Christie, there is nuance to it because so much of her work, particularly with her two main characters, is about being subversive within kind of British society at the time. So Poirot is a Belgian refugee. Mm. He is he plays with his foreignness all the time mm-hmm. as a way of getting people to tell him more or trust him or not trust him. Miss Marple is an elderly woman who people kind of just assume doesn't know what she's talking about, and they really underestimate her until she stands up and says exactly who the murderer is.
And that's exactly the thing. It's that underestimating them. Mm-hmm. And as you say, they're playing on the things that were seen as lesser than or quirks or in the past, in the period that it was written.
Yeah.
And the fact that that's actually a mainstay and a part of the novel means that Agatha Christie is in on that.
Yes.
She's in on how ridiculous that is and how one shouldn't underestimate these characters and how foolish people are for them, whether it's they're misogynistic or whether, you know, it's they're xenophobic or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. She's very aware, and she's written that into the tapestry of what the novel is and what the character is, which, you know, you have to give her credit for that. She knew how snobbish certain people could be and how they could be fooled or fooled into thinking that they were cleverer than they were because of that. So, you know, it's all quite interesting and quite clever how she's, you know, she's not there standing on her pedestal sort of saying this is how it is and this is why this happened. She's going into deep characterization of people.
Yeah. You know. And that's right.
And I think nasty traits as well. Very, very horrible traits, which, my goodness, I think, you know, I think we've proven over the years that we do love a character with a nasty trait, don't we? There's something quite appealing about getting into the nitty gritty of people who have faults. Maybe, I don't know, it's a sort of holding up a mirror to ourselves. And it's quite interesting to see how far it goes when it goes to its darkest sort of points, maybe.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is a perfect moment to dive into the book we're going to be talking about today, which I'm so excited about, which is Murder on the Orient Express. I'm just going to give a brief historical note before we get started. Murder on the Orient Express was published in the US and the UK in 1934, although in the US it was originally published under the title Murder in the Calais Coach because of a Green book that was published at the same time called Orient. It's a Poirot mystery, and it has been on many lists as one of the greatest mysteries and certainly one of the greatest Christies of all time. This is clear in the fact that it has also inspired many adaptations, film, television, radio, and even a very popular video game, which is mentioned in our episode with Matthias Vestergaard, who talks about his love of this game. Those include the 1974 film directed by the great Sidney Lumet, who directed a few of my personal favorite films, including Serpico, which is one of my favorite films of all time. The film stars Albert Finney as Poirot, Ingrid Bergman as Greta Olsen, and Vanessa Redgrave as Mary Debenham. It's a fabulous, fabulous film. And there it was also a 2017 version starring and directed by Kenneth Branagh, and a 2010 ITV television adaptation starring David Suchet as Poirot, who of course we love, and also Jessica Chastain was in that one as Mary Debenham. And the ITV version actually is interesting because it's not a a television length adaptation. It is a 90-minute film, even though it was on television. Murder on the Orient Express is a classic closed mystery in which all the suspects are on the train and no one could have either come in or left. It's also a great showcase for the, quote, little gray cells of Poirot, who shows his ability to solve a murder simply just by sitting back and thinking. It has an ending that would have been kind of like the perfect murder if Poirot just hadn't been on the case. You know, it's one of those, like, you darn kids from Scooby-Doo moments. And the central plot point, the murder of the child, is based on the murder of Charles Lindbergh's baby, which took place 2 years previous in 1932, which was obviously an enormous, enormous media case at the time. The setting for the mystery was inspired by trips that Christie herself took on the Orient Express, starting for the first time in 1928, as we know that so many of her locations are inspired by real-life experiences, and also a 1931 trip in which the train that she was on, the Orient Express, actually stopped for 24 hours due to flooding, and that inspired not only the setting, but also a handful of the characters in the book, which we know from a lovely letter she wrote to her husband, Max Mallowan, about that experience. So that's my little note about the book. Paula, would you mind giving us a 1 minute or so synopsis of Murder on the Orient Express?
I will. I'll try not to give too many in case somebody hasn't read the book.
But, okay.
So it starts off, the backstory is that small child, little baby, has been kidnapped and apparently ransomed by a gangster called Cassetti. And unfortunately, the ransom is paid, but it's revealed that Cassetti actually killed the child. So the child was murdered, which is very much along the lines, as you say, about the Lindbergh, which was a real mystery and murder that happened in the 1930s, which was a really horrible thing. I mean, even if you don't know about the Agatha Christie novel, a lot of people have often seen the headlines from the 1930s because it was the most dramatic and awful news at the time. And so we go to the train, which is the Orient Express, the beautiful, luxurious, fabulous sort of like cross Europe train. And on this train, we have an American businessman called Ratchet, who I'm trying my hardest not to do it in the right order, so I don't give it away. And several other passengers. Now, Ratchet feels that his life is in danger, and Poirot ends up being called back to London. He's in the Middle East himself. He's called back to London, so he joins the train. And he joins the train, and everyone's already on it. Ratchet realises that this is the famous Belgian detective and asks for his help because he feels his life has been threatened. And subsequently, Ratchet is murdered, and nobody knows who the murderer is. The whole train comes to a stop in this sort of like a whole snow and avalanche, and they're trying to dig the train out. And while they're trying to dig the train out, Hercule Poirot is the person who is trying to discover who killed Ratchet. And what we find out is a reason for many of the passengers on the train to being the potential perpetrator of the crime, and we eventually find out who or whoever could be the responsible. Goodness me, I want to say.
You can.
I find it's such a good ending. We are so used to whodunits where somebody, it's very much like a play, isn't it? Because it's a play. So you're very used to having all of the suspects in a line on a chair on the stage.
Yeah.
And then you'll have the investigator sort of talking through, and it's always this very elaborate story where he's showing his skills of knowing things that people thought that he didn't know. And then suddenly it's ta-da, you know, that's the person who is responsible for the murder.
Yeah.
But this is one of the reasons I love it so much. It's such a beautiful, sort of end. Well, the ending is questionable, you know, how it just kind of gets left quite abruptly.
Yeah.
But the fact is that they're all involved. They're all involved. And it's amazing. They all have a reason for killing Ratchet, who actually turns out to be Cassetti, if I may say that.
You may.
And, you know, because he was responsible for the death of the baby little Daisy, and they all have a reason for vengeance. And I think one of the reasons why I am particularly drawn to this one, and I think a lot of people are drawn to this particular novel, is because it's one of the few novels where we all feel, okay, no, we understand why, you know, not that I'm an advocate for murder.
No, of course.
But we sort of all understand this one. We all feel the emotion, and we all can understand how wrought and how distraught they've been. This has traumatized all of these people for so long.
Yeah.
And they have come together with one purpose, and that is vengeance, which of course vengeance is not a very nice trait to have. But when it comes to the death of a child or the murder of a child, I think there is a collective understanding as to what motivated them, and that's perhaps what makes this quite unusual.
Yeah.
As a murder mystery, in that as a reader, there's a part of you that can get behind it, you know, and totally understand it and sympathize in many ways, especially when, you know, he's shown no particular remorse, and in actual fact seemed to have gotten away with everything and is living a very fine and wonderful life. Which of course he doesn't deserve to do.
Yeah.
So, and I think that's why I was drawn to this particular one. Like you sort of feel you have an understanding as to why the events occur as they do.
Yeah, that's right. And I think often Christie's quite good about not, you know, she'll kind of not overly judging victims or murderers. And I think in this case, the way that we get such a judgment of Cassetti is that he not only caused the death of the child, but he also, there's this ripple effect where he also causes the death of the mother. And then the father kills himself. And then the maid, who believes she is being held responsible, also kills herself. And so there's this kind of ripple effect that goes on. And so many people have not only died, but then been affected by those deaths. And he, as you say, he seems to be living a very nice life. He is living in fear of his life. He's kind of allowing himself to be afraid for his own death. And
just desserts.
Right, exactly. And it is one of the few times where, I think it might be the only time where we really see Poirot abdicate the role of judge. Because he has the option at the end to turn them in, and he chooses not to. And it's a very abrupt end, as you mentioned, which I actually find very strange, and I don't know why it is written so abruptly. I wish there was a little bit more runway where we maybe see the train get back on track and see kind of everybody leave the train and so on. Why do you think it's ended so abruptly? Or does it bother you or not?
I think when you're really into a book, you want more.
Yeah.
So yes, you do want to find out what happens when they will arrive back. You do want to find out whether, goodness me, maybe somebody actually feels the need to confess. Mm-hmm. Because can all of those people really, with a clear conscience, can they all live with what they've done, even though it may have felt good at the time, it may have felt like justice at the time, and vengeance is a sweet thing when it's being performed, but is it something that affects you even worse in the future? Their lives have been destroyed in so many ways, but they've also added to that by being the murderers themselves as well. So yes, I in the sense that I never want a good story to end, I would love to have had a more rounded ending. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I think the minute you start analysing Poirot's thought process too much, it's great to find that he got to a conclusion. He understands, he knows what's happened. Mm-hmm. It's all revealed. We know why, and we know what's happened with everybody. You then wonder whether, if we continued, is he going to then have doubts? Is he then going to feel, oh gosh, you know what, maybe I do need to disclose what happened? Is he going to have a conversation at the other end with somebody who he can't lie to? Because at the moment he hasn't lied to, he's not going to disclose what happened, but maybe we shouldn't go through those conversations. That's a bit too revealing. Maybe it will sort of make cast a sort of different view of how we view Poirot, perhaps. So maybe, you know how some things are meant to be left to our imagination? Mm-hmm. We've probably all got a sort of resulting scene, an end scene of our own, haven't we?
Yeah.
That we imagine what happens when they get to the other end. Maybe that's a good thing.
Yeah. I love all of the points you just brought up, one of which is that imagining those characters having to then live with what they've done is actually quite daunting, especially because we learn so much about how gentle so many of the characters are and how opposed to violence so many of them are. And part of the reason it takes Poirot so long to get to the conclusion is that he doesn't see many of those people as murderers. He really doesn't. He doesn't believe they have it in them. And that's why so many of the stab wounds are so light. Because they really didn't, some of them are just because they're like the princess is very physically weak, but some of them just simply did not want to stab.
Absolutely.
So it is.
The plotting, it's so often the plotting and planning of a situation is probably so much so much easier. I mean, I do it all the time. You know, I will sort of like say, you know, going on a day out or going to a special event. And, you know, there's always that moment half an hour before the event where you're thinking, oh, my goodness, why did I say I'd go to this? Why did I say I'd commit to this? Because the fun was actually in thinking about it and sort of like the planning what you're going to wear, what you're going to do, or how you're going, you know, what's going to happen.
Yeah.
So they've had this awful tragedy on their minds for so long. Of course the plotting and the planning is going to feel, you know, almost invigorating. You know, they really want this to happen. They need that vengeance. When you're faced with a human body, a sort of like a beating heart and warm flesh in front of you, and you know that you're going to participate in something that's going to cause the end of that, I mean, that's very daunting and horrible. And, you know, it's you can understand why the mother is, you know, goodness me, a mother's love and a mother's anger at losing not only her grandchild but her daughter, but also her unborn granddad. You know, she was pregnant, and then her son-in-law. Everybody else, of course, they've all got a reason to be angry and furious. But when you're then faced with a beating heart in front of you, I mean, that is awful. Which is why, you know, they are condemned to their own sort of prison, aren't they, afterwards? Even if it's a prison of the mind, you know, they'll never get over what they've done.
Yeah.
Just as much as they'll never get over why they did it.
I think that's so right. And it's the one time Poirot doesn't play judge. And, you know, he has this line that appears throughout so many of the books where he says, "I don't approve of murder." And often in cases where the murder is justified, he'll still turn the person in and say, I just don't approve of murder. I don't think you should be able to take God's will into our own hands. And this is the only case that he lets go. So it's a fascinating one to me because it is a true out of character moment for a character who is so himself throughout every other book. I mean, he's in 33 books, and this is the only time that this happens.
It's a very human thing, isn't it? It sort of brings him out of just a character that has certain quirks and certain very rigid ways about him, and it actually throws him into the human, because of course, you know, we all know that it doesn't matter whether somebody is the CEO of a massive company or whether they're a policeman or whether they're this or the other, so much human sort of nature and sort of human emotion comes into every decision that we all make. And there's bound to be a time when we may go against certain beliefs or certain our conscience or something because of something else that interferes with the route that we feel we ought to go down.
Yeah.
You know, that's a very human feeling and a very human response to trauma and to certain situations.
Absolutely. And I do feel, you spoke about kind of your gateway to the Christies was the adaptations. And in terms of the adaptations of this book, of which there are so many, I do think that the David Suchet version captures that the best. He has a really, I mean, he brings so much humanity to that character.
Absolutely.
But that kind of ending where you can really see the distress in him having to let this go, but knowing that he is going to, is such a beautiful moment in that adaptation. Mm-hmm. It unfortunately, I don't think really plays out that way in the 2017 version, and I can't really remember the end of the 1974 version, although I remember visually that film so well because it's so beautiful.
It's beautifully shot, but also it's the cast of
the cast is amazing.
My goodness, I mean, you've got Ingrid Bergman, you've got Lauren Bacall. I mean, it's stellar, isn't it? And it's and also it's at a time when a lot of the actors, especially the female leads, were towards the end of their sort of careers, or you know, a lot of them, of course, acted for a long time afterwards. But in terms of their glory days, when they were seen as young and beautiful starlets or whatever on the silver screen,
that's right.
And what meaty roles for them! I think it's such a such a good film with so many good female characters yes. that they were really able to get into, which is brilliant. You know, if nothing else, that was so good as well, wasn't it?
Yeah. And that the plotting is largely done by women. And they kind of are the ones who figure out the ins and outs of a very complicated would be perfect crime. Of course, only women could do. but you're right. That cast for the 1974 film, and particularly Ingrid Bergman's role as Greta Olsen. I mean, she was so good in that role.
Amazing.
And although
I must say, I loved Michelle Pfeiffer as well in the 2017 one. I do think that I did enjoy her that one. I wasn't asking, although I did think Kenneth Branagh did an amazing turn with the huge moustache and... You know,
he certainly had a big mustache. He had
fun with that character, that's for sure. But I love this sort of continuation of films and reimagining of films.
You do.
Over different generations. I really it doesn't detract for me to see the different versions. If anything I sort of like enjoy it more and more and more, you know. And as I say, I think it's when you really like a story, when you really are engrossed and involved in a story, you want to read that book over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. So in actual fact, to have different opportunities to see people's different interpretations of how it all pans out.
That's true.
It's brilliant. It's great, you know.
Yeah.
I don't think any of them have been awful.
No.
At all. You know, I've enjoyed all of them, some more than others, but yeah. I've enjoyed all of them.
And it's such a great setting. And I think that is what is so wonderful about this book and why people keep adapting it. Can you talk a little bit about kind of the aesthetic of the Orient Express and why you think that might be a setting that appeals to people?
Oh my goodness. Well, it's just a dream, isn't it? The idea of being in that sort of fantastic, beautiful sort of coach with the lamps and the white linen starch tablecloths and the upholstered seats. And the whole aesthetic is so luxurious and gorgeous, but it's not sort of, there's nothing tacky about it. There's nothing, it's very over the top luxurious. However, because it's set in a certain period of time in the 1930s, there's something sort of quiet luxe about it. Yeah. It's sort of it's very genteel.
Yes.
It's, you know, I think, my goodness, I mean, I've never been on the Orient Express. It's now the Belmont, isn't it? But the Orient Express. But it's something that I plan to do at some point. I love the whole, because they kind of kept it with that sort of old-fashioned aesthetic. Even the staff are wearing the lovely sort of porter's costumes with the little hats. And it's so beautifully done. It really is like you're stepping back in time. Yeah. And then, of course, you're looking through the windows and you're seeing, I don't know if you're doing the Paris to Venice, you're seeing the most incredible landscape, for instance. It's bringing that whole period of time to life in the most beautiful and safe way, I'd say.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we've also got to remember, you know, the 1930s towards, you know, it wasn't the safest place to be, you know, whoever you were, it wasn't the safest place to be going through Europe, was it, you know, and sort of like coming from the Orient and into Europe. So it's one of those things where it's beautiful to imagine it, but once again, vintage style, not vintage values, I suppose.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, we spoke about the pace of life earlier, and I think that like traveling by train really falls into that category because, you know, most people don't have the time to travel by train as much anymore.
It is a luxury. Yeah. It is a luxury, but it's sort of, you know, and especially a luxury to have, you know, it's the fine dining, it's the amazing cabins, to be able to sleep on a train properly.
Yeah.
You know, you don't really have that. I think we have it in the UK up to Scotland. But even then, you know, it's nothing like, you can take special trains, the sort of Belmont Express, which is the Orient Express, the same style. You can take those specific trains. But if you're really just going to travel up to Scotland or something,
right,
you might take the sleeper cabin, but, you know, they're nothing like the Orient Express.
Yeah.
So it's the whole, the upholstery, the lighting, the whole mood of everything is slower paced. The fact that you've got your cocktail hour and proper sort of like table service with the waiters, and then you've got you know, you may have a big band or a pianist there. I mean, it's incredible, like going to the most fabulous cocktail party in London or something, or New York or Paris.
Know. I mean, the idea of changing for dinner on a train, you know, is like so foreign to us at this point.
Oh, and you know, I love the idea of having any excuse to change for dinner, but especially on a train. I mean, how wonderful. You know, you're making my juices flow now. I definitely have to book myself. I'm going to have to book myself a ticket.
Absolutely. And you said you've never been on this particular express, but have you ever traveled in this kind of like train setting?
You know, I've been on the train because I am from South London originally. I live in the countryside now, but I'm from South London originally. And so my train to come into central London was Victoria Station. And the trains leave from Victoria quite often. And they go down to the coast, and then you get on a ferry or something and order train, and then get on the other train on the other side to go to Paris. So I used to see I've seen these trains for years. I'd come in on my very normal run-of-the-mill train and see these beautiful trains with the carriages and the incredible sort of script written on the side. And then you'd see the little lamps on the tables. And I'd think, goodness me, who on earth gets on those trains? Where do they go? And once again, the romance of it all. And you know that you're going to dress up together. There's no way you could go on those trains in jeans and a T-shirt. You know, not that I'm a jeans and a T-shirt girl, but, you know that you're going to, my goodness, you want to wear a hat. You want to have a little turned brolly that's sort of like vintage, like a parasol or something. You know that you're going to dress up, and you know everyone else is going to sort of have the same care and attention to what they're wearing, just purely because they're on something that is so steeped in history and just so beautifully romantic.
Oh, that's so lovely. I want to ask you a question that I've been thinking about because I've been, you know, following you as a writer and a content creator for a long time. And you've spoken a little bit about what it's like to be a content creator who's of an older generation and how that can be a bit isolating because there are not as many who are visible. And that's something that I think within this book and also Poirot in general, I mean, that is something that he experiences over and over again as a retired detective, that people kind of don't know who he is anymore and he feels a bit out of it. And maybe like he's losing like his name and his reputation.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I was wondering if you kind of feel connected to that in any way in terms of like, do you feel that the fashion and vintage, I suppose less so vintage, but like the fashion and content creation worlds are difficult to break into at an older age?
I think it's very interesting, actually. And to use, as you've mentioned, the parallel between myself and Poirot, as the books span quite a long period of time, you know, as you say, 33 novels. And I know towards the end, his style doesn't change, but of course the world has changed.
That's right.
And so he's got his spats and he's got his, you know, his turned moustache and all those things that were completely made him brilliantly dressed in the 1930s, make him a bit out of touch, you know, a few decades later.
Yeah.
And as a woman, you know, I'm 53 now, and I used to work in the fashion industry. I used to work for a fashion magazine. And I distinctly remember when I was in my 20s, I felt I was the height of fashion. You know, I used to go to the fashion shows and with the magazine and everything. And then I moved to the countryside in my late 30s, early 40s. And I had a period of time where I sort of disappeared. I sort of like withdrew into myself. And it was a time of I was morphing into a different sort of person, and my values were changing, and I was really enjoying my surroundings and living with nature and really bringing up the children and all that sort of stuff. And then social media started creeping into my life, and I had this duality of this love of fashion for my old life, but my new life was all about, you know, growing vegetables and buying vintage furniture for my house. And so the combination of those two things is why I became sort of Hill House Vintage, because to me, I didn't want to chase trends. You know, those days had long gone. It was all about, for me, having a timeless style, but still having fun with it. And vintage is a beautiful way of doing that. And my version of vintage, you know, not everything is strictly vintage.
Yeah.
I just have a vintage aesthetic.
Yeah.
I like to have an essence of the past. The way I dress is not necessarily, I do sometimes dress in real vintage, but you know, back in the 1940s, ladies tended to be a bit smaller than I am. So sometimes it's actually quite hard to get the, you know, those beautiful little nipped in waists, the right size. But I have, yeah, it's just an essence and sort of an image of what the past may have been, my own interpretation. And I think I've gotten around the needing or wanting to stay relevant by stepping away from trying to chase a trend. Yeah. You know, I think it's wonderful when I see older content creators. They're not that many, but when you do see them and they're looking fantastic and they're trying anything new and whatever, I think that's brilliant.
Yeah.
I find it exhausting. I've been in the fashion industry. I know what it was like to try and keep up. I have no interest in keeping up with anything. Yeah. I like to try and live life beautifully as I can. And that also means having a beautiful mind, which is a calm mind and a mind that doesn't feel that you're missing out on something or you can't do something. And it's the best way to live life with positivity is not trying to keep up with something. So that's what I do. And it seems to interest people. So as long as it interests people, then that's great. You know, mm-hmm. it's I'm just going about living my own sort of, you know, relatively boring life, but you know, people seem to like me kicking up a skirt or you know, playing around with a watering can and wearing a pair of high heels in the garden or something. You know, I'm having fun with it.
But I think that's what people connect to is the fun that you have with it. And what I've always found so inspiring, as you say, not everything that you have on your feed or in your book is vintage specifically, but it's about finding your eye, I think, because anything can be made beautiful if you find the thing that you like. Yeah,
that's it. And it's but also it you know, I'd like to think that Poirot is so happy with his style that, you know, if he gets the odd dig or the odd sort of criticism, you know, when you find your happy place, that's a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
You know, that's a good thing. And it's funny, actually, my husband used to talk about his granny, and his granny had this certain hairstyle, and it was a sort of 1940s wartime hairstyle. And he always used to say when he was younger, he couldn't understand why she had an old-fashioned hairstyle. You know, why does granny not sort of like move with the times?
Yeah.
And it was only as he got older that he realised that we all often wear or have things that remind us of our youth. She was just wearing the hair that she had always worn in her 20s and
30s. Right.
For her that was young. And I don't think she was trying to be young, but that's just what she did. That's how she wore her hair. Mm. And I think that's wonderful. She loved her hair like that. And she did her little victory rolls, her little sort of curls, and she looked fantastic and it was wonderful. And I think if everyone settles, and it doesn't have to be from your own childhood, because I mean, mine, I love things from the 1950s and 1940s, and I can tell you I wasn't around then. But, you know, it's sort of, if you settle into a look or an aesthetic that makes you feel good and makes you feel happy, then gosh, blow anyone else.
Yeah,
you know,
that's
right. Wear your spats and have your big curly moustache, I say.
That's right. And I think the moustache is exactly Poirot's thing that he, you know, he gets mocked for it endlessly through the books. And another thing for him that he's often mocked for is he's quite dandified. And he wears patent leather shoes, even when he's in the country. Mm-hmm. And almost to a book, I think, every time he has to go out walking in the mud and he's wearing patent leather shoes, one of the characters says, "Oh, you really should have brought brogues. This was, you know, your feet are going to be in so much pain." And he goes, "I like to look smart." And
he
never apologizes.
He doesn't apologize. And that's a very important thing, really, because you shouldn't be dressing for other people.
Yeah.
You know, the only people who are uncomfortable in that situation are the people who are looking and thinking, "My goodness, aren't those patent leather shoes getting dirty?"
Right.
He's thinking, "Aren't my patent leather shoes looking smart?"
Exactly.
You know, and he's, you know, as long as he's feeling good in them, I always feel with me, I can never be too overdressed. You know, I'd rather be overdressed than underdressed. You know, if I go somewhere and it's a bit casual, I'm just like, well, I don't do casual. It's fine. You know,
Your casual is
I feel happy.
Your casual is just a few steps above everybody else's casual. Well, thank you so much for being here. This has been so much fun.
Oh, it's my absolute pleasure.
Really appreciate you coming on the podcast and talking to us. And I hope everyone will, who hasn't already, I'm sure many people already know, but Hill House Vintage is your blog and your Instagram. And we'll also link to your book all in the episode notes. So everybody can please go and check those things out. And
thank you so much.
Is there anywhere else you'd like to be found, or can the people find you somewhere else?
Do you know, at the grand old age of 53, I'm sort of like, I'm on TikTok now. I can hardly even believe myself, but I'm on TikTok as well.
Oh,
so,
my God.
I like showing pretty things. There is a few book things because there's a few things in the background that are bubbling up that'll be quite exciting and quite relevant to what we're talking about as well. So I won't reveal too much, okay. Yes, it's the mixture of beauty and mystery is something that will play a big part of my life in the future.
That is so exciting. I can't wait to hear more. And I can't believe you're on TikTok. I can't bring myself to get on TikTok. It's too many platforms. There are too many platforms.
So many platforms, yeah. Isn't it? You know, honestly, so many platforms. But it's interesting. Social media is probably the thing that dragged me back into the 21st century. So I'm sort of going with it. You know, my clothes are old fashioned, but my social media is up to date.
Well, your Instagram account is one of the Instagram accounts that I look forward to seeing in my feed, because I've kind of scrubbed everything that doesn't make me feel good, or, you know, makes me feel bad about myself, or any of those things that social media does to us that are not nice. I've scrubbed that all from my life. And so it's like flower accounts and furniture and vintage and just things
Absolutely.
That bring me joy. And I think your account is such a great
example.
Such an
important decision. Yeah. Thank you so much. And that's so important. And anyone who's listening, do it. You should have things on your eye, in your eye line, that bring you joy. It's one of the most important things you can do for yourself. You know, nourish your mind and your body, but sort of definitely nourish what comes into your brain, you know, and that should be good things, even though we're talking about a horrific murder mystery.
But it took place on a beautiful train, so that was
absolutely. It's a beautiful train. Absolutely.
Well, thank you again so much for being here, Paula. It was such a joy, and I hope you have a lovely evening.
Thank you, and you.
Okay, bye. Thank you to our producer, Kate Kreshel, and our sound engineer, Winter Robinson. To stay up to date and get some fun extra info, you can follow us on Instagram at TNMurder. Rating and reviewing us on iTunes or Apple Podcasts really helps, so please do that if you feel so inclined. We're on all your favorite podcast platforms. Please remember to follow us there and recommend us to anyone you think might need a little extra tea and or murder in their lives. Next episode's book is Murder in Mesopotamia. Rent it from your local library, buy from your local independent bookstore, or if you need to buy online, we recommend bookshop.org, which supports independent bookstores with every purchase. Link for next episode's book can be found in the episode notes. Thanks for joining us for this episode of Tea and Murder. We'll be back in 2 weeks. Don't miss us too much.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.